Okay, welcome everybody. Next week is Rabbi Hartstock. And in July, stay tuned. We'll definitely have the Parsha share through Tisha B'Av, meeting until the 19th. Maybe take a few breaks, and then we'll resume towards the end of August. I'd like to thank Dr. David Berger, who each and every time that I ask him, he agrees to speak, and every time it's very interesting. And if you like him tonight, you can hear him pre-mincha. He's the guest speaker pre-mincha as well. Without further ado, Dr. David Berger, thank you very much.
And Miklal Heina Tashomei Allah. So if you don't like it tonight, stay home on Shabbos. So I decided we should talk about one of the most mysterious passages in the Torah. I remember my one of the best teachers in Flatbush High School, Amnon Haramati, with whom I learned the Devarim, began the class on Parshas Vayeshanan by saying that this is the passage that bothers him the most in the Torah, is God's refusal to allow Moshe to go into Israel, and it's not at all clear why. So I managed to have other things in the Torah that bothered me also, but this was the thing that bothered him the most. So what I'd like to do is discuss this parsha, or the major issues in this parsha, in order of the parsha itself. And so I'm going to begin with something that is really peripheral to the key issues of the discussion, but it's something that I was once involved in an exchange with another professor, with Menachem Kellner of the University of Haifa. Now he's elsewhere. He had written an article, contrasting is too strong a word, but discussing the attitudes of the Rambam and the Ralbag to women, to the capacity of women. Now, we all know that the Rambam's opinion of women's intellectual capacity is not quite in accordance with contemporary sensibilities. But Kellner argued that compared with Ralbag, he is a feminist. And he quoted a passage in Ralbag about what I think I could describe as the intellectual vacuousness of women's abilities. I wrote something about the attitudes, about the uses of the Rambam in the 20th century. One of the anniversaries of the Rambam's death, in this case. I mentioned that his, whatever things the Ralbag might say about women, it's impossible for him to have believed that women's innate, what we would today perhaps call genetic intellectual capacity, was completely lacking. Once you are a woman, you know that you don't have intellectual abilities. And the reason that this is impossible is that Ralbag was a medieval rationalist, Aristotelian type philosopher. Those of you who heard Daniel Reinhold's talk about the Rambam may recall that he said this about the Rambam, but it's all the more true, at least as true of the Ralbag, is that prophecy has a naturalistic element to it. A person who reaches a certain level of intellectual and imaginative abilities can connect to God or to the active intellect and become a prophet. Someone who doesn't have that cannot become a prophet, period. God doesn't pick people out to be prophets if they don't have that ability. And there were 7 women prophets. And even if you don't accept every one of the women on Chazal's list, there are women prophets who are identified as such in the Tanakh. Miriam and Huldah and Devorah and so on. So the Rabbah couldn't have taken the position that he did, in my opinion. So I was prepared for this year, and I looked at the Rabbah, and I came across the passage that is on your sheets. The last two sheets are Rabbah sheets, and the first of them, the one that's labeled Rabbah Al Torah 1, so I guess it's in the you have it. Look at the marked passage that I called Miriam. The passage of Mei Meriva begins with Miriam's death. And Chazal say that there was a be'er of Miriam and it ceased to work, and that's why they didn't have what to drink. So, the Ralbag writes as follows. Vayavol b'nei Yisrael kol ha'ida ad sof ha'parsha. Okay. V'lo ha'ya ma'im lo ha'ida. Miriam. The story was placed right after Miriam's death. Okay, that's a standard rabbinic statement. The death of tzaddiki makes an impression. Vech Shovani says, and I think Shagam Miriam Ahaya, or we would say today in Hayasa, right? Mosheches Lady Israel Bechochma Sa. La'avot Hashem Yisaleh. With Miriam's wisdom, she got the Jews, she attracted them to serve God. Uchi'ilu Amar, and it's as if the Pasuk was saying, She'im ha'yisah Miriam b'chayim, if she had still been alive, lo harsu Yisrael b'zeh ha'ofen lishol ha'mayim imoshe b'divrei kinturin ka'ele. The Jews would not have behaved this way if Miriam was still alive, because of her wisdom. The reason for this reference is to note for us, if she had been alive, Moshe and Aaron would have consulted her, with respect to that which God commanded them, the Dibartem El Hasela. He would have prevented them from stumbling with respect to this command. She was older, and she was a prophet as well, and they would have sought her advice. So I just preface this by pointing out that we have here a striking indication that the Ralbag did not reject the position that women could reach the highest intellectual level. And that's just the kind of an aside at the very beginning. Usually an aside comes in the middle, but this one came at the beginning. So now we turn to the story of Mei Meriva. I think the first thing that one has to do when you finish reading this story is compare it to the other story, which is in Shmos, about Moshe miraculously bringing water out of a rock. So if you will turn in the Chumash to Shmos Perek Yud Zayin, it's worth looking at some of the details of that story so that we can compare them to our story. It says, if you're looking at the Yud Zayin, Perek Yud Zayin and Shmos at the very beginning, at the end of the first pasuk, it says, "Ve'ein ma'im lishtos ha'am." They were in Rephidim, and there was no water to drink. So they fought with Moshe, and they said, "Give us water." And he said, "Why are you complaining to me and testing God?" And then it goes on to say again that they were thirsty. and they complained to Moshe and asked him, why did you take us out of Egypt to kill us in thirst? And he calls out to God. He says that they're about to kill me. And God tells him, Pasuk Hey, Avor Lifnei Ha'am, you should go in front of the people. You should take the elders of Israel. And you should take the staff which you used to smite the Nile. I will stand before you on the rock at Chorev, and you should hit it, and water will come out of it, and people will drink. That's the story here. Now, if you compare at least some of the details with the story of Meriva, you find a number of differences. They are not monumental, but they are probably significant. And we'll get back to the significance at the end. If we look at some of the differences, in Shmot, the Ziknei Yisrael are the primary figures who witness this. In Bamidbar, it is the nation as a whole. In Bamidbar, the complaint of the people is initially stronger. They don't complain so much right away about being thirsty. They say that God essentially brought them out of Egypt, or Moshe brought them out of Egypt to this terrible place. And we have nothing to eat. They say to Moshe and Aaron, you brought us here to the desert to die, we and our animals. And Moshe and Aaron retreat to Ohel Moed and fall on their faces. This doesn't quite happen in Shmos. And we'll get back to what might be the significance of some of these differences. Now, of course, the other differences, the glaring difference, and the one that's most important initially for our concerns, is that in Shmos, what does God tell Moshe? Hit it with your staff. And here he says, speak to it. So, the first question that we need to ask, our instincts, I think, as Bernie Stoll actually mentioned in his Bar Torah that he said next door, which I heard part of, is that Moshe takes the staff. What is the staff? Moshe's staff, the one we know about that we associate with Moshe. And if we take a look at the Ramban that I noted on page Kuf Ayin Bet, see there is a mark there in the Ramban where I wrote Mateh Shel Moshe. Let us look at the Ramban there. He's commenting on the assertion that Moshe was asked to speak to the rock and not hit it. And he says, but this is problematic. Why? Ki mei achar shetzivo kachas hamateh, once God commanded him to take the staff, yesh b'mashma sheyakebo, that implies that he should use it to hit the rock. One could add, after all, that's what he did the last time something like this happened. If God's will was that he just speak, what is this staff doing in his hand? That means you should take it and use it to smite. So, the fact that Moshe was told to take the staff implies that he was supposed to hit the rock with the staff. Now, this the key element of this It has to do with the nature of Moses' sin, and we'll get to that in a few moments. But the element of this that I'm interested in this minute is that the Ramban takes it for granted, as I think we did most of our lives, as I did most of my life, that this Matez is the one we know about, Moses' staff. However, I actually first learned this from Chizkuni, but Rashbam came first. So let us look. Before we look at the Rashbam and the Ramban, I'm sorry, and Chizkuni, let us actually look at the biblical passage that they refer to. If you go back to Parshas Korach, Perek Yud Zayin, Pasuk Tet Zayin at Chamishi of Korach, you find a story that you all know very well, that after the Korach incident and the punishment that was imposed, God tells Moshe that he should tell the Jews to give them their tribal staffs from each Nasi and write the name on the staff, and then write Aaron's name on the staff of Levi, and leave them in Ohel Moed Lifnei HaEdus, and one of them is going to miraculously flower. And it was Aharon's that flowered. Verse 23, Vayehi mimocharos, vayavo Moshe Elohel Hoedus, vayine parach matei Aharon leveis Levi, vayotze perach, vayotze tzitz, vayigmosh kedim, without any naturalistic explanation for this. So Moshe took it out, and then God tells him in Pasuk Chafhei, Hosheves matei Aharon lifnei ha'edus, put that back in front of the luchos, basically, the mishmeres leos lifnei meri, as a sign for rebellious people. That is the story, the most recent story about a mate, much closer to our story than the stories about Moshe's mate, even though those are more frequent and more prominent. So, let's see what the Rashbam says. On page Kuf Ayin Bet, the same page we were looking at before, where I wrote the words Mate Shel Aharon in the margin. I wrote that word on the margin twice, but the top one is Rashbam. And Rashbam says, Kaches Hamate, and he says, Milifnei Ha'edus. So you know right away what Mate he's talking about. The Mate that was put Lifnei Ha'edus was Aharon's. Maybe I won't read the next two lines in Rashbam yet, but rather take a look at Rashbam, the Rashbam continuation on Kuf Ayin Dalid. I marked that Rashbam is the top mark on the page, and Rashbam says that this refers to the Mate Tzivolo Kachas. He commanded to take the Mate L'harosbo kishi meri shelohem, to demonstrate their rebelliousness. Kidichsiv l'mishmeres l'os livnei meri, which is the reference earlier to the Mate of Aharon. And I will now right away say what is now the obvious, although it was not the obvious for most of my life. And that is that Moshe addresses the people at Meriva as Hamorim. Shimuna Hamorim. which once you see this interpretation, the word Morim leaps out at you. These were B'nai Meri. Now, if you look at Chizkuni, back on Kuf Ayin Bet, at the bottom right, where I also noted and wrote Matesh El Aharon, you have the clear formulation. Zehu Maklo Shel Aharon, Deha Ksiv Kan, Vayikach Moshe Es HaMateh Milifnei Hashem. That's what it says, right? He took the Mateh from before God. If it was Moshe's Mateh, we don't really know where that Mateh was, but we don't have any special reason to think that it was before God. But we have every reason to know that the Mateh of Aharon was before the Eidus, which is Milifnei Hashem. Yeah.
Two questions. First of all, it's not precluded that it's actually the same Mateh. The Mateh of Moshe could have been the one that actually was inscribed Aaron's name on it. It's not precluded. That's a possibility. But more importantly, isn't there the whole gap of the Arba'im Shana B'Midbar between the Maaseh Korach and Kol Adaso and that Aaron and this and the death of Miriam?
Okay, there's an even larger gap between the last reference to the Mateh of Moshe.
Is this the name of the
Yes.
I'll get yours.
And beyond that point, it was placed lifnei ha'edus lemishmeres la'os lifnei Mary, which means that it was
permanent.
Yeah, it was there as a reminder. So presumably it stayed there. I mean, that was its place. So you have a really strong reason. Yes.
So you mentioned looking back at Shema, you see a riot to this immediate position because on three occasions where Moshe is told about the Mateh, it's Matcha, not his Matcha.
Okay, but you may be bringing us into a small problem. Which I'll get to in a moment. Let's just finish reading that Chizkuni so you'll see him formulate this as strongly as he can. And he says, V'zehu maklo shel Aharon, k'dichsiv b'farshas Korach, we're at page Kuf Ayin Bet of the handout, at the bottom of that page on the right, Chizkuni. Hashev es matei Aharon lifnei ha'edu esliv shmer sos nei Mary, right? The old the Maklo shel Aharon hayo osliv nei Mary behind the Mar Moshe Shimuno Hamorim, and Moshe made a mistake. What is a little bit problematic about that? I mean, this is really, I think, pretty convincing, except for one word, and it's actually related to what you said, but in the other direction, namely. That in our story, if you look at page Kuf Ayin Vav Pasuk Yud Aleph, what does it say? Vayare Moshe Yado, Vayaches Hasela B'Matei Hu Ta'amayin. So the fact that that's called Matcha, well, here you also have Matehu. So this is a little bit of a problem. Now it could be. I'll mention a very clever. I don't know if it's true, but a very clever resolution of this as we go on in Kli Yakar. But at this point, one can still say that once he was holding it, it's described as Matei. I think you can say that without too much trouble. All the more so if it's the same Matei.
Is Matehu Mateh Shelo?
Yes.
Or is it like Mateh Hazem? In other words, the Mateh that I was talking about.
No, Matehu has is Mateh, yes.
Okay.
Hayo Alehu Ranon, right?
Okay. Just thinking. Bernie.
Yeah.
The
Mateh
of Aharon is in a place that nobody can see, right? It's just next to Aharon. So if it's going to be an Os, it would make sense that it has to be taken to a place where people can see it. Does it make sense for it to be an Os next to the Aharon, where nobody can go and it's Aharon? once a year. So in other words, that would be a riot. That if the thing came to be an oath, I think that it should be an oath that people can see it. That might be a riot. That's what it has to be taken out.
Is what it's needed for that purpose. It has to be removed. Yeah, that makes sense. Kliyoker has a very interesting observation along these lines, although I'm gonna hold what he says about the Matehu for a little bit later when we talk about the sin. Now we're still just talking about the staff. I think this is a really very clever idea, and he thinks so too, because he tells us, you know, nobody really understands this passage, so now listen to what I have to tell you. At this stage, what he says is very interesting, I think, and that is that the use of the Mateh of Aharon, which is what he thinks this is, and he credits Chizkuni, although he says Chizkuni doesn't explain it fully. He doesn't explain the connection between this Mateh and this story. Now, that's really not true, because the connection is that it's Mishmeret Lo Livnei Meri, and these are B'nai Meri. So the question is not, in my opinion, a particularly good question. There is a good reason for using this Mateh without what Chizkuni, what Kliyoker is going to say. But what he says is very clever. He says there is a specific connection between the Mateh of Aharon and the miracle that is to be brought about through this Mateh of having a rock produce water, because this was a dry stick and it produced flowers and shkedim. How does that happen? That can only happen through lachluchit, through a certain degree of moisture being produced miraculously from this dry stick. So Moshe is showing this, they're supposed to show, shows this to them, and what he's supposed to do is say, just as this miracle involved the production of moisture from a dry object, so God will produce water from a dry stone. Which I think it's really a very clever idea. That would mean there was a double reason for using Aharon's staff. One is that's a Mishmeret Lo Livnei Meri, and the other is that it actually corresponds to the planned miracle. So now we come to the crux of the difficulty of this passage, and that is, what was Moshe's sin, and what explains his punishment? There's a laundry list of suggestions as to what Moshe's sin was. Or HaChaim lists 10 suggestions. Abarbanel, I think, lists 11. We're not going to go through 11. But the fact that this is the case, indicates how challenging this passage is. So the first explanation of what the sin was is the obvious one. He's told, the obvious one is what?
He's told to talk.
Talk. And he violated God's instructions, which is the understanding of Rashi and others. And with this explanation, we understand two of the key words in God's assertion of what the sin was, which was Ya'an lo ha'emantem bi lahakdisheni le'enei b'nei Yisrael. Verse 12 on page, beginning on page Kuf Ayin Zayin. I don't have the next page in front of you, and it continues, Lahakdisheni le'enei b'nei Yisrael. You didn't believe in me, and which, had you believed in me, you would have sanctified me in the eyes of the Jewish people, and you didn't do that. If the Siddur is what it seems to be through an immediate reading, we understand those words. Moshe was told to speak to the rock, and that it would have miraculously produced water, and he apparently didn't believe that that would work. So he decided to hit it. And had the miracle happened in the original way, God's power would have been more evident than it was even what emerged from what actually did happen, which was in itself, of course, miraculous. So that this has the advantage of being the plain meaning of the text, and it provides us with an explanation for the rather strong language that God uses to Moshe and Aaron. But the Ramban and others don't like this. And so let's go back to the Ramban on page Kuf Ayin Bet and take a look at his objection. Kuf Ayin Bet, page Kuf Ayin Bet, which is the first page of the and let's go back to a few lines that I already read with you, but we'll continue a little bit, where it says, Matesh el Moshe. The Ramban is objecting to the explanation that I just mentioned, Rashi's explanation, and the explanation of the Chazal and whatever. Why? He says, Avol lo nischavru. These words are not really clear. They're not right. At least not clearly right. Ki me'achar she'tzivo kachas hamateh. Once he told them to take the staff, yesh b'mashma she'yakevo. That means you should hit with it. Why else great take it? Right, we read this already. And now we're at the last line of that Ramban at the end. Ki hakosuv yikatser b'davar hanishma. When it says neteyas yodcha or tikach biyodecha, it means to hit. Just that the Torah will not write something that is obvious. V'ein ha'neis gadol b'dibur yoser me'ha'ha'ko'o ki ha'kol shaveh eitzel ha'sela. It's not a big miracle to talk to the sela and it would produce water. Yeah, that to hit it and it will produce water.
As far as what the Ramban is asking, Rabbi Yoah makes a big deal that by Amalek, Moshe says, I'm going to take the staff. He goes up, and the staff seems to disappear.
Yeah.
Would that be, whatever is going on there, would that be, I don't know if you call it a stira or something like that, to what the Ramban is saying? Because we have a version case in Chumash in which I'm going to take the staff. His hands, the sukkim talk about his hands, and there doesn't seem to be anything in there.
Yeah, so this is actually a point that Cleoker already makes. About how he took it and then apparently didn't use it. I agree with you. This at least could be seen as a counter argument. Given the fact that the Ramban doesn't think that there's any bigger miracle speaking to a rock and having it produce enough water for all of these people than there is in hitting the rock and having it produce enough water for all of these people, then the assertion that Moshe and Aaron didn't have faith becomes problematic as well, because talking and hitting don't make a difference. And if you look down at the passage that I marked in the middle of that column on Kufayin Gimel, the continuation of that Ramban, where the first words are Pasuk Yud Bet in parentheses, he says, let's read the previous line as well that I didn't, I started the mark one line too late. This doesn't justify saying you didn't believe in me to sanctify me. There is no lack of faith here at all. So he's not happy with this explanation. He then goes on to cite the Rambam's explanation. The Harav Rabbi Moshe Savarbo Svoga. The Amar Ki Moshe Rabbeinu Olof HaShalom Chet Ohu Shenoto Litzad Harag Zonus The Amro Shim Uno Hamorim. He got angry when he shouldn't have gotten angry. And the phrase Shim Uno Hamorim is the manifestation of that anger. A person like him should not have lost his temper. And if you then skip to the next marked passage, which is still the Rambam, he's still quoting the Rambam. He quotes the Rambam as saying, with a considerable amount of satisfaction, "V'hineh hitarnu sofek misfekei haTorah." We have resolved one of the difficulties in the Torah. Shenemru bo dvarim rabim. About which many things have been said. Many times people ask, what was his sin? Take a look at what people have said about this, and then see what I said about it. And you decide what's correct. The truth will direct, there's an expression to mean the truth will emerge from this examination. Eilut v'Rav Zal, that's what the Rambam said. And now the Ramban uses one of the sharpest expressions he ever used about the Rambam. I don't claim absolute bekius, but I think this is the sharpest thing that the Ramban ever said about the Rambam. Hosif hevel al havalim. He added nonsense to all sorts of nonsense. Why? Shahakasuva mar mirisem pi. Later on, the pasuk says about this story, you violated my command. Shavru avaro. Lo amar lo hemantem bi. Shelo heminu bo. What does it have to do with anger? Ein ha'onish babu shekaas. And then he says some more, which we don't have to read now because of time considerations. So the Rambam is not only wrong, but is talking nonsense, because the psukim simply don't fit that sin. And the Ramban cites the explanation that he says is the best explanation to satisfy our concerns. If you don't know what we would today call Kabbalah, if you know the mystical reason for this, there is an explanation which he provides at the end, which we're not going to read. But he said, if you don't know that, here is the best explanation that we can give, exoterically. Non-esoterically. So let's go down to the passage that I marked at the bottom of Kufayin Gimel on the left. The Hakarov min hadvarim shenemru bazeh. The best of the explanations that have been given for this. Who told litchos hashoel? If someone asks you, you can push him aside plausibly with this answer if you're not going to teach him the secrets of the Torah. The sin is that they said, will we take water out of this rock? We will take out. And they did not say, if you turn to the next page, as they said, and so on. And it says in all the miracles, Moshe attributes them to God. And here, He didn't mention God, and that would weaken the faith of the people. And that's what Lo Hamantem Bi means. And let's look at the next, you know, the tiny passage that I marked a little further down on Kufay and Dalit. V'yihyeh. See, that's the line that begins with a vav and a close parenthesis. In the middle of that line. V'yihyeh Lo Hamantem Bi Yotzei El B'nei Yisrael. What does that mean? How does Lo Hamantem Bi follow from their having not attributed this miracle to God? So Jews wouldn't believe that it was done by God, they would believe it was done by him. So how does the word Lo Hamantem Bi fit here? So he says, Lo Hamantem would be Yotzei El B'nai Yisrael. I mean, you know what that means?
It was a lost opportunity.
Yeah, but what is the
he makes the hemantem to be a verb.
Well, it is a verb.
No, I mean a verb in the sense you did not create emuna.
He makes it the hifil that it is in the usual meaning of binyan hifil. Binyan hifil is when you cause something, someone else to do something, vayal besh, rather than yilbash. Hilbish means I dressed another person. Right. So the typical use of hifil is to cause someone else to do something. In this case, to cause someone else to be dressed. So he'emantem lo yan lo he'emantem bi means you did not cause them to believe in me. Now the trouble is that l'ha'amin appears, you know, frequently enough in the Tanakh, and never means that. This is a hifil, and there are such hifils that are not, they're not the typical hifil. L'ha'amin means to believe. It says about Moshe, about Abraham, v'ha'amin b'Hashem v'yachshev ha'olot tzedakah. Doesn't mean he made somebody else believe in God. So this is a real dochak, but it's an effort, and he, the Ramban, is the only one who does this. It's an effort to have a sin of Moshe that really doesn't reflect lack of faith by Moshe, and in order to preserve Moshe from having been, not having had proper faith, you do what you need to do with Hebrew grammar. Let me then give a final explanation, which is the Kliyakos explanation that I said I would get to, which is really interesting, but I don't know if it's likely to be true. Remember, he said that the Mateh is the Mateh of Aaron, right? And that's very plausible. And he even added this very clever analogy between the dry stick producing a moist product and the rock producing water. But then he says, it says Hamateh throughout this story, right? Take Hamateh, and Vayikach Moshe es Hamateh Asher Tzivohu, right? As God, this is on page Kuf Ayin Vav at the top in the text of the Torah, Pasuk Tet, Vayikach Moshe es Hamateh Mibifnei Hashem Kasher Tzivohu. He took the Mateh, which is the Mateh of Aaron, from before God, as God commanded him. He fulfilled the commandment of God. But then, two psukim later in Pasuk Yud Aleph, it says, Vayore Moshe Vayore Moshe es Yodo, Vayaches Hasela b'matei hu pa'amayin. He wasn't going to hit the Sela with a staff with flowers and shkedim. You don't hit a rock with a flowery staff. Now he took Matei, who? His Matei, the one that we all thought he was dealing with all the time as we were growing up, and he hit it with that Matei. And God never told him to do that. He just thought that you have to hit the rock the way he did back in Rephidim. and he wasn't going to do it with this inappropriate matah. So he took his own matah, with which he had did all sorts of things in the past, and that's what he did, and that was his sin. And by doing that, you know, the name of God is not sanctified, at least not to the same degree.
So what exactly was his sin? What exactly was his sin?
The sin was that after taking the correct matah and holding it and showing it to the people, he then took his tried and trusted old matah and used it to hit the rock. And that's why it says the matayu.
What did Moshe think was the purpose of taking Aaron's, according to this,
because makel? Because it's a mishmeres l'osif le'meri, and he.
So they would see this.
They would see it, and they would also see, from the Kliyokra's perspective, they would also see how a dry object could produce moisture miraculously. All of that was proper. But when he thought, maybe because of what he did in Rephidim, that he's expected to hit it in order to get water, he took his original matah. It's hard not to like this. It may also be hard to think that it's pshat. I leave it to you to decide what you think. There's just one other point that I want to make.
We'll daven Meyer before here. So.
Okay. Before discussing the punishment, and that is that there are a number of psukim that attribute Moshe's punishment to the sin of the people, rather than to his own sin, or at least not just to his own sin. There are a number of places. First of all, I don't know if we have time for you to actually, you know, turn the pages and look, but in Dvarim, let's do it. Dvarim 121, Moshe says, in a somewhat different context, but if you look at the Dvarim Perek Aleph, Pasuk Chaf Aleph, it says, let me see, do I have that right? No, that I may have. Oh, yeah, 1 second. No, it's a little bit late. Hold on.
Vatamru?
Yeah.
Chafei? Chafav?
Anyway, there's a place where Moshe says he said that you would not go into the land. I'm sorry. It's Lamed Zayin, Pasuk Lamed Zayin. Gambi hisanaf Hashem biglalchem lemor, gam atolo savosham. So God told me that I wouldn't go into the land because of something that you did, which presumably means the lack of faith that required God to perform this miracle. Somewhat indirectly, Moshe was punished because of a defect in the people, and here he was giving Musar to the people. And once again, let's see if I wrote the right pasuk down this time. In Devarim 4:21, this time 21 is correct. Vashem hisanaf bi al divrechem. So Moshe understandably emphasizes the responsibility of the people, and you have a similar assertion in Tehillim Kuf Vav Lamed Bet, which reads Vayaktsifu Almei Meriva Vayera L'Moshe Ba'avuram, because of what they did. Now, So the question is, the final question is, why was this so terrible that Moshe should have been punished so severely? Rashbam, there's no time to read it, but Rashbam considers everything Moshe did b'shogeg, and he said that it's one of those cases where God is medakdek with tzaddikim kechut ha'sa'ara, that God imposes requirements on tzaddikim that he would not impose on regular people. But there is at least a suggestion that's been made in various contexts by various people. There's an article that a rabbi from Teaneck, Rabbi Helfgott, wrote years ago in Tradition, comparing the Rafidim episode to this one, where he also says that there is something here that may reflect something about the leadership of Moshe and the nature of the miracle that God wanted to bring about here. The people here, this is the first story that comes after the 40 years of the desert. This is a new generation. And this is a generation that hadn't seen the miracle, not with their own eyes, at least not as adults, the miracles of Yetzias Mitzrayim and even the revelation at Sinai. And they were about to go into the land of Israel, as Bernie said in his Dvar Torah, right after Mincha, into a more natural environment where they would not be exposed to miracles all the time, or have the benefit of miracles all the time. And so probably, at least possibly, God found it necessary to try to impress them with his miraculous providence that they weren't going to be seeing routinely anymore. And that's why it was so important that this miracle happened differently from the miracle in Rephidim. This one had to be in front of a larger number of people, not mainly Zakenim. And this one had to be not by hitting the rock, but by the even more remarkable event of speaking to it. This is a transition that the Netziv discusses. There is a much larger goal here. Moshe was accustomed to lead the older generation, his failure over here may have been taken by God as an indication that his task had been completed, and that someone else with a different orientation has to lead the people at the next stage.
Go ahead. We'll have the Marv right here, unless they happen to walk out.